This podcast is brought to you by Bert Bielema's Booty Boot Camp for Fitness and Wellness.
Menace to Society.
All right. Thank you for tuning in. Just since you last joined us, this thing is exploded. Since last episode, we've surpassed 75,000 listeners and downloads and people that are tuning in, and we're at a rate that I never imagined reaching. We're at about 5,000 to 7,000 per day without new content getting put out. So I want to just remind everyone, subscribe and download now on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or go to our website, which I got some feedback. I got an email that I think it said, you don't have to say www. It sounds like you're trying to sell air conditioning or a tube TV back in the 90s. So you can join us or subscribe to the podcast. Also, you can contact us on menacetosocietypodcast.com. In the next month or so, we'll be solidifying the minimal sponsors and advertisers we select. So if you are interested or want more information at a media kit, please email me at Zach, Z-A-C-H, at menacetosocietypodcast.com. Also, we're going to introduce Patreon, which is a way for us to interact with our listeners. It'll be coming soon. We'll detail that later. But it'll be 100% funding the expansion, growth, and increasing the frequency of this show. We also have had some great meetings with some partners, and we're going to be launching a merch line coming soon. And I got to tell you, if you are a fan, student, or human being that likes West Virginia, TCU, Oklahoma, Iowa State, or Baylor, boy, do we have something special coming for you. When the mighty Longhorns of Texas come to town, you will not want to miss the shirts and merchandise we are putting out for you to dress yourself in for that game. So pre-orders will be opening up in a few weeks, and we'll kind of promote that through social media and through the next couple episodes so that you can see what we got coming. I wanted to start this off. A guy that I follow on Twitter, an Ohio State graduate who's a pitcher in the, I think, the Arizona Diamondbacks organization. His name's Bradley Goldberg. He tweeted something that kind of spoke to the motivating factors of this show. And he tweeted, the issue is most of not all will always want or need a job, and know that using a platform like Zach Smith is will be a death sentence for future jobs. And I can't reiterate enough, that is what makes this unique. No one in this industry, this avenue, this venue can speak the way that I'm speaking because there's fear. There is this fear that they'll never get another job. And I am a former college football coach that doesn't ever want to coach again. So I'm able to give a perspective into this industry that no one else will do. There's others that can, but they won't. And see, here's the problem. There's these people or groups of people, and it's all avenues of life, that have power and money and think they can supersede normal, proper etiquette and action. I had something recently happen a couple months ago with Sandals Resort. I had purchased a vacation, right, probably a year and a half ago. And I wanted to cancel it, couldn't find my passport, it was out of the country, and so I tried to cancel it. And they were like, oh no, just push it back a year. So I did. Well, fast forward a year, this is probably this past January, obviously I lost my job, finances weren't as good as they used to be, and they charged my card like $3,000 out of nowhere. And I called them, and they said it was because the rate had changed. Right. And I fought them through the bank, my bank, fought their company. And moral of the story is, like happens in a lot of walks of life, they were a powerful and rich organization. I was just a human. There's nothing I could do. And that is consistent. That is President Drake. All the money and the power in the world thinks they can do anything they want. And what I found is the power to battle back is finding a voice, the power of the people, right? A voice, a platform that's far more powerful than money. The greater good for this country is influenced by voices, or should be, by platforms used to inspire change for the betterment of the majority. So the good thing is, I will not shut up. I refuse to sit silent. I will continue shining a light on the wrongdoings and disservices that people with power think they can get away with. So many people, including people working in athletics, are tuned in. So many people love what we are doing. Alternatively, so many people are nervous. So many people hope that I stop or calm down. The good thing is, college football fans crave more. The reason college athletics is a monstrous money-making machine are the fans. And they want to know how their favorite sport works. So guess what?
I'm going to tell them.
So getting back in to our previous show, like I said, 75,000 listeners, astronomical growth. I mean, I couldn't have imagined or thought this would happen this fast. The one thing I will say, I want to touch on, one of the biggest stories from last episode was the KJ Hill story, right? A lot of traction, a lot of responses on that, and a lot of anger from Arkansas inhabitants that were mad that I called it a backwoods state, and I apologize. Problem being, I'm not that sorry. The way your state treated a great kid, a great family, and it was backwoods. I hate to break it to you. Not my fault. Your state was backwoods. Your state was a bunch of rednecks that mistreated a great kid and a great family. Not my problem. Even the articles that were written, talk about clickbait. I saw an article by, I don't know who it was, probably one of these websites for Arkansas football and some college kid writing it that wanted to detail my background and how I was, I guess, lacked credibility. And the problem was, KJ tweeted and corroborated it. So, Razorback fans, I apologize. Didn't mean to hate on you or your state, but the funniest thing that happened, I don't know if you guys saw this, I didn't realize that people call Brett Bielema Bert. That was the funniest thing ever. I'll never call him Brett again, so that's the last time you're going to hear me say the name. From now on, he will be Bert. That is hilarious. I do want to shout out to Dre the Buckeye Kid 28 for starting the gift challenge he started on Twitter. I mean, we were all texting about it and, I mean, crying laughing about you find a gift that represents one of the stories from Menace Society podcast. So if you haven't checked it out, look him up, Dre the Buckeye Kid 28, and look at the gift challenge because it is hilarious. And I would love to keep it going and I'd love to see what people come up with because it was really funny.
There are a lot of good ones out there.
Oh my gosh, many funny ones. I did have one thing that came up and I tweeted it from the Menace Society podcast Twitter account because there was a question asked about funniest things I've heard on the headset, and I completely forgot to mention this. There's a hilarious story about the 2015 season. It's been well documented in this show when Ed Warner was the coordinator and all the incompetencies and funny and not that funny things that happened. And one of the things that happened that I completely forgot to mention was probably about game five or so, things were not going well. Urban was extremely upset because the play calling was horrendous. And so he stripped that responsibility from Ed, right? He took it away and was like, this is not working. And he tried to do it a very political way. Like, you know what, Ed, you got a lot going on the sideline. It's hard to see. I don't know how you do it. I mean, I'm on the sideline and I can't see what's going on. And that's hard. I mean, I don't think you can do that. Plus you're coaching five guys, you know, the offensive line coach. He was making all these excuses to try to not piss Ed off and not make some, make the offensive staff any more disjointed. Right. So he took the play calling duties and gave
it. Who took it over? Okay, go ahead.
Tim Beck was up in the box, and so he gave it to him. Well, Ed really struggled with it, and he because of perception, he didn't want people to know that the Ed Warner was not calling the plays. So he was on the sideline. He was only concerned about perception and TV, right? Mm-hmm. So he had every game he would have this big call sheet made up, and I used to laugh because our GA, this poor kid, was, I mean, he was having to make this additional call sheet for Ed, and I used to look at our GA like, hey bro, you're wasting your time. I mean, that literally would be like,
what the hell is it for?
Right. It was a call sheet for a guy that wasn't calling shit. Think about that. Like, that'd be like me buying you a car and you can't drive. Like, yeah,
I'm a 14-year-old.
Yeah, what a waste of an automobile, right? So anyways, he would make this call sheet. And the sole purpose of this call sheet was so that Ed, on the sideline, just in case the camera was on him, you know, this big-time coordinator, he would take the call sheet and cover his mouth and microphone like you've seen these NFL gurus do, right? So that they can't steal the play call. He would put it over his mouth so that when the play was being called, it looked like he might be calling the play.
Yeah.
But that's not what's funny. I mean, that is funny. That's funny that that happens at such a high level because, wow, the incompetence. But the funny thing is when he would do it, all you'd hear was... And it was like you could hardly hear because all you heard was breathing. And Urban would get furious but could never figure out what it was or who was doing it. And he'd be like, who is doing that? Who is breathing like that? And I'd be like 20 feet away looking at Ed like, it's this son of a bitch right here. Like, what are we doing? And he would get irate. And it was hilarious. Like, I forgot about it. And here's the funny thing. You talk about losing credibility, losing your leadership role. Those headsets, I mean, there's players on them. There's two backup quarterbacks on the headsets. So they would see this, experience this, hear this. How are you supposed to lead when your subordinates are witnessing incompetence? That's the question, right? So I just wanted to bring that up and... Now we can get into the rest of the show, but I forgot about it and I didn't want to let that go, especially because I tweeted about it.
Yeah. All right. So we have to talk about this. We were talking about it before we started recording this podcast today, but what I've always wanted to know recently, and I think all the fans of Ohio State and probably across the country would like to know, do you think Urban Meyer will coach again? I know there's a lot of traction looking at USC.
So
what do you think?
I'll give you some. I'll give you a little backstory on this. So everything that happened at Florida when he retired, resigned, whatever you want to call it, I was coaching at Temple when everything at Ohio State started happening. And people ask me all the time. Obviously, I've known Urban for whatever 20 years, and so people would always ask, like, "You think he's going to coach again?" And I mean, adamantly, I was like, "Absolutely not."
I always thought, no way. And then the Ohio State job opened, and I was like, it might be happening. I don't know.
There's one place. Yeah, that would be the place, right?
I will tell you this. I sat in a staff room at Temple talking to the coaches, just kind of in casual conversation, probably a week before I got hired at Ohio State. And to a man, they were like, you think I'm hearing Urban's getting the Ohio State job? And I'm like, no, he's not. He's not. He retired. Like, he's spending time with family. He's on ESPN. He's not coming back to coaching, right?
He had that awesome, like, booth job. I mean, I wouldn't want to leave that.
So I told everyone, absolutely not. And sure enough, a week later, I'm employed by him at Ohio State. But how about this? So I got a little birdie told me something.
Oh, Jesus.
So a little background. I'm from Dublin, Ohio. It's a little well-to-do suburban city outside of Columbus, right? Born and raised when my grandfather coached here. Obviously, my family lived here and never left. So I was born in Dublin, Ohio. I know hundreds of people in Dublin, Ohio, like anyone would, that grew up somewhere. Coincidentally, that's where Urban lives. And so I know pretty much if you live in Dublin, like anyone else that grew up in Dublin, lived there their whole life, I probably know someone that either cuts your grass, works with the guy that cuts your grass, their brother cuts your grass. Like, I know someone that is around you, right? So I had I don't even want to call him a friend of mine, someone that I know that works in the United States Postal Service dropped a bomb on me last week. He tells me that Urban Meyer, his address, his house, has had certified mail delivered to and sent from to the University of Southern California. I'm talking several letters.
Wow. Really?
I mean, several correspondence.
Well, what could that be?
So I will go on the record. Again, I don't know that he has communicated with them. It's a decent source. Mm-hmm. I would... I So if you're asking me to put $1,000 on Willie coach again, I would put $1,000 that he will be the head coach at USC in the near future.
Well, who even is USC's coach right now?
I think it's Clay Helton right now, but let's not forget, like, that's not really a relevant question, right? Because if you rewind to 2004, when Urban was the hot coach at Utah, do you remember what happened with Notre Dame and Florida and all that? Because he had a clause in all of his contracts prior to going to Florida when he was at these mid-major schools that if one of his, I guess, ideal jobs, Ohio State, Michigan, or Notre Dame, came open, he could get out without a buyout or anything, no questions asked. And so Notre Dame fired Tyrone Willingham to get Urban Meyer. And then Florida fired Ron Zook to get Urban Meyer. And then he had a decision to make, and he picked Florida, and that's when Notre Dame started spiraling. That's when they hired the Weissman, Charlie Weiss.
Charlie Weiss.
And that is when it all went to shit in the Golden Domers.
Well, land. Those two teams, they weren't doing very well, but what if USC does really well?
Depends if they think they can get Urban Meyer,
That's a good point.
And here's the thing that I guess people don't really know is, and Urban used to talk about it all the time, and a lot of people have talked about it, is his wife, Shelly, absolutely loves the West Coast, like loved it at Utah, loves warm weather. I'd imagine she can't stand the winters in Ohio like anyone can't. And so we'll see. But my sources are telling me that there's a good chance he might jump back into coaching. And that will be complete egg on the Ohio State University and the President Michael Drake.
Well, this obviously wouldn't be the first time that he stepped away from coaching to get back into it.
Right.
But let's talk about kind of his first tenure then at Florida and kind of what went on in the program. And
yeah. Oh, yeah. We previewed it last episode, and I want to dive into it. What I called Urban Meyer's Florida under the hood. The one thing I want to talk about, someone commented on our very first episode about this, I forget the name of it. I always reference it as the Vaginitis Project. It's some like dweeb looking guy that clearly is an average at best reporter, like went undercover with these hidden cams and started interviewing these former players of Urban Meyer's that to just trash his name. And you talk about a low budget film. It's like probably won the Indie Film Award. Bizarre. But I do want to talk about, as I get into that, because here's what happened. This nerdy guy went and interviewed four players, right? Go figure. They were four players that did not have a successful career, did not pan out, had some injuries, and they also were very young when Urban left. And here's the thing about Urban's program. When you first get there, you're miserable. Like, it's awful. And people hate it. When you're a coach that gets hired, you hate it until you start to grow and develop. And what's funny is he didn't interview Tim Tebow or the Pouncey Twins. He didn't interview anyone that had success. And Urban always used to tell this story about working. He was referencing it in respect to working for him or Nick Saban or someone that's an elite level coach, right? Or leader. And he'd always talk about Steve Jobs. And he'd say, I think he read a book or he might have spoken with him. But either way, he was talking about Apple and how some people just hated working for Apple because Steve Jobs was so demanding, such an asshole, right? Such a jerk. And Steve Jobs used to say, look up there at that mountain. You see that mountain? You see that all those multi-million dollar houses? Those are all executives at Apple. Go knock on their door and ask them how it is to work for Steve Jobs. I guarantee they don't say anything negative because that's what happens, right? The people that don't succeed or can't take it, they're always the ones that want to bitch.
Well, they're just disgruntled.
Always, yeah, disgruntled is the word.
You did something wrong. That's why I'm not successful.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so the question is for the Vaginitis Project, why didn't you interview Tim Tebow? Bet you he'd have told you a different story. And what it outlined was, the funny thing is it outlined a story that you talk about firsthand witness. I was the one that was there. It was about a kid named Omarius Hines, who was a great kid, tough kid, really a good player at Florida, and was a good player after he had this injury, this incident. He still had a successful career there, still played, did really well, but he had an incident. It was something that was called the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, and that is what it was called back then. It since has been renamed the St. Valentine's Day Celebration, because massacre obviously was an inappropriate word, and especially after this incident. But he was doing leg press, and I think the biggest issue he had was he was so tough that he was going and going, and this was leg press to failure. And so he was doing leg press. He must have done 30 reps. They're just taking plates off as he fails to do more, do more, do more. So we walk, and I'm right there, one of the strength coaches, and I can't remember who the player was right there, but we're there at the leg press, like watching him do it, like encouraging him, motivating him. So then him and I walk over to the dumbbells, and he starts doing this shoulder workout after the leg press, and then it goes into manual shoulders. And I'm the one, like, with my hands on his arms, doing manual shoulders with Omarius Hines. And as he's doing it, he looks at me, he goes, "Hey, coach, I don't feel well." And mind you, like, I know this kid, he's a freshman. I know him pretty well. As the GA, you usually deal with the freshman. And I was like, holy shit, this tough-ass kid just is, something's not right. And I was like, all right, bro, we're good. Like, go get some water. And so he starts to go get some water. He collapses. And I'll never forget, because Tim Tebow is standing right there. And we're in the dumbbell area, and it's really just me, Tebow, and Omarius Hines. And Tim looks at me and goes, "Should I go get someone?" And I'm like, "Bro, he's unconscious. What the fuck do you think?"
"Hell yeah.
Go get..." Yes. And so he takes off, goes to get a trainer. Well, this kid had what compartment syndrome in his quads and thighs. And that's like, that's a medical condition that normally is like from a catastrophic event, like a car accident. Jeez. Or it was bad. But the funny thing is, three of the four players that were interviewed that brought this up as this was an incident of abuse on Urban Meyer's account weren't even there. They were the next class. They hadn't even enrolled yet. They weren't at Florida yet. And they're sitting there talking about it. Like, "Oh, yeah, his legs blew up, man. And it was Urban threw Gatorades at people." Like, what? Time out. Stop it. And so I wanted to address that because I had a comment, and I'd never seen it. I actually went and watched it. And I'm sitting here like, this is such bullshit. And I'm not even defending Urban. Like, he has many flaws, many faults. There's times where he stepped out of line when it came to dealing with a player, like anyone has probably. But I couldn't not talk about it. And so I wanted to bring that up. And I also, the off-season program, the Valentine's Day workout is actually one of my favorite workouts. That one, and then there's another workout that Mickey Marotti does called the Harley Davidson workout, right? And he always does it like right before spring ball during bike week in Daytona. And so it's crazy. It's really cool. All the strength coaches dress up in like leather, like bikers.
Of course.
The one strength coach who's awesome is Jeff Uhlenegg, and he has a Harley. And it's, wow. I mean, it's like there's trash bags put over the window so the players can't see in before the workout, like the anticipation builds. It's really cool. And then they get in there and Yuli will ride in on a Harley into the weight room. Vroom, 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 and I mean, nice. Like revs it up. And I'm talking about, I'm getting chills thinking about it. It's like the players are hollering.
They're probably hyped.
But those workouts are what make the football team.
That's got to be unique to just Coach Mickey probably.
He's done some really cool things.
Unreal.
Like the Valentine's Day one's awesome because it is legitimately, both of them are a 2-hour workout, two straight hours, and everything is circuit training to failure. So, I mean, the players, when they're done, are absolutely exhausted. And it's really, really cool because it's when you, and all the coaches are in there, and it's when you see the team start to come together. Mm-hmm. And like he does really funny things. I remember, so at the Valentine's Day workout at the end, he gives out candy hearts, you know, the "Be Mine," "Kiss Me."
That's so awesome.
But the players love it, man. And don't get me wrong, some of the younger players who aren't that tough yet, they hate it.
Yeah.
But like the older, I'll never forget. I mean, they'll do like, you know, like these huge, thick ropes, and they do like the kid will sit down and do a rope pull. And that used to be my favorite thing, is to get on there and just challenge them mentally and pull against them. And there's some guys like, you want to talk about when you knew Paris Campbell was going to be a great player? It's in a Valentine's Day celebration. It was like, you'd see him on a rope pull and you couldn't break him. You're sitting there pulling against him. Three guys are pulling against him, and he's not stopping, not quitting. And it's just like you're watching it like, God, this kid is going to make it, man. It was so cool. And so for anyone to trash that as abuse, sorry, development looks a lot like abuse, especially if you can't take it. And I wanted to bring that up. I also wanted to talk about when I found out Urban was resigning, because I was there the first time. Because I don't know if you remember, he resigned twice at Florida.
Yeah,
he resigned once, walked away, and then came back.
I remember, yeah.
And then resigned, retired the next year. Mm-hmm. And so I was there the first time, and I'll never forget it because no one saw it coming. At least I didn't. And I was been in the program for 5 years. I'll never forget his bowl practice. I had already accepted a job at Marshall, but we were still doing bowl prep. And I'm sitting there doing my job as a GA, like running the scout team defense. We're kind of grinding, going through practice. And Urban was the kind of coach that was so very involved in the offensive practice mostly, right? Like you could never have an offensive drill or segment of practice that he wasn't right there and in the middle of it. And we're doing this practice, and I'll never forget the assistant strength coach, one of my best friends in coaching, comes up to me behind me. He goes, "Hey, bro, the duck is out." And so that's what the support staff used to call him, the head duck. And he said, "The duck is out." And I looked
at him. This was just right before the bowl game?
Yes, bowl prep. And he comes up to me. He goes, "The duck is out." And I like look over my shoulder. I'm in the middle of coaching. Like I'm like, "Bro, what are you? First of all, leave me alone." Like, and he was like, and I was like, "What do you mean the duck is out?" And he goes, "Look at him." And I look over. Urban is on the next field over, looking at the grass, wandering around, kicking dandelions. And I'm like, "Holy shit, he's about to quit." Sure enough, we come off the practice field, and the DFO, Director of Football Operations, standing there. He goes, "Hey, staff meeting right now." We go up there, boom, bomb drop. I just want to let you, and it was like almost like a written statement. Want to let you know, personal decision. I'm going to resign as the football coach here this afternoon. And he walked out. And I mean, whew, I've never seen anything like it. And I'm a GA. I'm making $200 every 2 weeks. Like, you didn't take much from me. But these coaches were like, yeah. I mean, like, you just saw their whole lives destroyed. And I was like, holy shit. And why he stepped away, there was obviously health concerns, which I've already talked about. And they were legitimate. But what really happened is I think he lost the program. He lost control. The program was slipping. He started losing control a couple years earlier. And I mean, shit, I remember a year earlier, and I wanted to tell the story. I mentioned it earlier about Percy Harvin. Percy Harvin's a great player. Had a lot of issues. Had a lot of, it was a struggle, which I've already talked about with the whole Pete Carroll story all that. Mm-hmm. But I'll never forget when I knew Percy was different. I was obviously a GA. I worked with receivers. Obviously, right? That was my career afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting in a meeting in the receiver room, and there was a confrontation. Percy's sitting there watching film, and there was another freshman named Jared Faison. If Florida fans probably remember him, he's five-star, great player, ended up transferring because he was the second fiddle to Percy Harvin, right? And so there was this animosity between Percy and Jared, and I'll never forget it. The receiver coach was kind of ripping Jared Faison, like, about doing something wrong, whatever. And he looked at the coach and he was like, "Man, you'd be doing that shit if Percy did it." And Percy turned around and was like, "Hey, bro, keep my name out of your mouth." And the kid looked at him and goes, "Percy, Percy, Percy." And so Percy, like, unloads on him, just starts beating his ass. And so the receiver coach kind of grabs Percy, and all of a sudden Percy spins around, puts both hands on the receiver coach's neck, and puts him up against the wall and starts choking the fuck out of him. Oh, and I'm God. In the back of the room like, holy shit, I don't even know what to do. And so this huge commotion, and then right next to the receiver room was the linebacker room, and Charlie Strong heard it, bursts in, and Charlie had a unique relationship. Like he had, you talk about a player's coach, like he had the player's heartbeat, the pulse. And he comes in, grabs Percy. He's like, "Man, what the hell are you doing?" Like, just diffuse the whole situation. But that was what started it, because then Percy played that game, kept playing, and that was when kind of the wheels started to come off of the program.
Dysfunctional.
Yeah.
It seems dysfunctional.
But we had so much dysfunction and so many, I guess you call them, unique personalities. And and one of them that I've been, I guess, teasing forever is Aaron Hernandez. Because now, with recent news, Aaron is one of two murderers that were on the Florida teams, right? Him and Tony Joyner.
Him and Joyner, yeah.
But Aaron Hernandez, and I teased it, and people kind of laughed, like, that's a weird flex. I wasn't flexing, but I knew Aaron really well. Obviously not well enough, and not, I didn't know what he was capable of, but he was very Eddie Haskellish, very, very, very intelligent, but he could put on a show. He could be like, if you met him, or if your mom met him, or your wife met him, they would walk away like, what a good kid.
What,
like,
a nice guy.
He could put that front on.
Yeah, he'd just be who he thought you wanted him to be at that moment.
But he was, I'm talking about just a little twisted, a mm-hmm. little different. And I remember it like to the point where he was like inappropriate and uncomfortable. Like he used to say things like, I'll never forget. Like I came out to practice one time and he was like, hey coach, you wearing compression shorts? And I'm like, what the fuck? Huh? No, I'm not. And he's like, I see that dick swanging right now.
Oh my God. Like,
Jesus Christ, man. What is wrong with you? And it was all like, it was a joke, but mm-hmm. it was not a joke.
There's something behind it.
Uncomfortable. Yeah. And he, I remember he used to, one time he had a pocket masturbator, I guess you call it. And Urban does bed check in hotels, and Aaron heard him coming. And when he was at the room right next to Aaron, Aaron like threw it, and I guess it stuck on the ceiling, and they videoed it. And like Urban walked in to check on them and make sure they were in bed. And this masturbator is hanging over his head, like stuck to the ceiling. But Aaron was very different. But he was also not what you would imagine. And Tony Joyner, too. Tony Joyner had a lot of issues, but he was a captain. I mean, he was, and I think part of that was trying to empower him. But I remember, and Tony Joyner, I think, had a drinking problem in college, like 99% of college kids have nowadays. But Urban and the staff knew Tony had some issues to the point where they made Tim Tebow be his roommate to try to, like, I don't know, Tebow, I think, was a freshman or maybe a sophomore. They made him live with him to try to help him. Yeah. And that's, people want to trash Urban and his program for these kids. And it's like, you recruit a kid like Aaron Hernandez, who was a great kid coming out of high school, great, like a good family. His dad passed away. His dad had like some random surgery, like removing a gallbladder, and then got an infection and died. And it was like that. That's when you saw a change in him. And it's like, what, did you not want to recruit him? He was a good kid. It seemed like everything would have told you he was a great kid. And he got to Florida, and then he was different. I mean, he had some issues, and Urban and all the coaches just tried to help him, just tried to make him better. And then fast forward 10 years, and now this guy is committed suicide, committed these murders allegedly. And it's like, did you know? Well, no shit. No, obviously not. Nobody knew. Nobody could have predicted that. And so Florida was interesting. And it was really cool to see the difference at Ohio State, because the cultures were so different. And we'll talk more about Florida in the future episodes, but I wanted to dive in a little deeper on that, mainly because I saw that project by the vaginitis people, and it just wasn't fair, to be honest with you. And I would challenge the vaginitis project to don't do what Brett McMurphy does. Try to get both sides. Try to find someone that had success and see what they say, because anybody, you could find a disgruntled person about anyone in the world, and if you just interviewed them, you'd have this amazing story about how awful they were. Problem is, that might not be who they really are. So I just wanted to clear that up, I guess.
So that was the culture, but how did it get there? What was like the recruiting philosophy and everything you guys did to get to that place?
Yeah. So recruiting, Urban's philosophy, he's always been obsessed with speed, but if the difference between Ohio State and Florida, he obviously evolved. And at Florida, it was all about signing the best player imaginable. Like, you could overlook a lot of things if it was a great player. And but he was definitely obsessed with speed, and that's why you look at kind of what happened in 06 and that team, and then 2008. I mean, every time we took the field, it was literally the fastest team on the field. And he was obsessed with it to the point where I'll never forget. This is a great testament to why he evolved. But Steve Addazio recruited the Northeast, right? And that's where he was from. He recruited there, and he had a great running back prospect that he loved, everyone loved. Kid was probably a 4'6 kid, and Urban didn't want him, right? Kid was a Florida fan growing up, wanted to come to Florida so bad. And we ended up turning him down and taking two other running backs, and the kid's name was Noshon Marino. And SEC fans, Georgia fans, Florida fans, they know Noshon. And we turned Noshon down to take Mon Williams and Chevon Walker. And no one, SEC fans, Florida fans, Georgia fans, no one knows who they are. But we took them because they were 4'4", 4'3 kids, and Noshon was a 4'6", and we paid for it because Noshon killed us when we were at Florida. We also turned down Carlos Hyde. Buckeye fans know Carlos Hyde, and he was from Naples, Florida. Another Naples, Florida native that we turned down was Jeff Heirman. Buckeye fans know him. We turned them down because they were not elite speed players. And fast forward, Urban got to coach him, though. But, yeah, he transformed that and evolved that thought. He still loves speed, but he would take a kid that wasn't elite fast if he was a great player. And well, that, not until we got to Ohio State, but he did.
I know that the speed at Florida was very evident in that, was it, 07 national title?
Yeah.
Because they were just running them out of the stadium.
Yeah.
They were so much faster than Ohio State.
Yeah, and that was his deal. But I'll tell you this much. We when we were at Ohio State, I can't remember the coach. It might have been it might have been Jerry DiNardo, one of the Big Ten Network coaches or someone. I'll never forget when we played 2014. He was like, that coach told Urban, he said, that was the fastest team I've ever seen. And Urban came in the staff room. He's like, it's not the fastest team ever, but that's just a testament to coaching. Those kids were so well prepared, knew what they were doing. It was just second nature to the point where they could play at optimal speed. They weren't the fastest player in the world, like Mike Thomas, not the fastest receiver in the world, but he was so well trained and so confident that he played as fast as he possibly could. And that was the difference.
Well, game speed and actual speed are two different things.
Yeah, and a lot of times coaches' confusion can hold a kid back. A 4'6 kid could play 4'8. A 4'4 kid could play 4'7 because they're confused or they're not confident. And a 4'5 kid can play 4'5 if he's confident and well-coached and well-trained. And that was the biggest difference. But I've also had a lot of questions about, like, what is your biggest recruiting regret? And I thought a lot about it, and I have two kind of personal regrets of kids that I wish I could have got so bad. And the first one is Christian Kirk, and fans of Texas A&M know him well. And he was a kid that I recruited really hard, and we were in it. He was really good friends with Johnny Dixon. He was one of the few underclassmen that went to the opening. He was a junior that went, and I think only two or three went. And he knew Johnny really well, and he was out of Saguaro High School in Phoenix or Scottsdale, Arizona. And that's a regret of mine. I wish we could have got him. He's a great kid. His family's awesome. I didn't do a great job recruiting him. Not that that's why we lost him, but he's definitely one that I wish we would have gotten just because he was an Ohio State type of kid. Just a great kid, really smart, really talented, and I wish we could have got him. The other one, who was probably one of the best receivers I saw in 5 years, was Jerry Jeudy. It was my recruiting area. I knew his high school coach really well. He's obviously at Alabama. He'll probably win the Biletnikoff this year, probably be the first receiver taken in the draft. He's just a great player. And I didn't really think we had a chance on him because Alabama does a great job in recruiting. And they also had his one of his high school coaches kind of in their pocket. And I'm sure people remember this kid. He plays for the Falcons now, Calvin Ridley.
Yep.
I recruited him also. Kind of was on the outside looking in on him from the beginning, but Alabama had his high school coach kind of tied down. And I don't know how or why, but Calvin went there, and Jerry was like a little brother to Calvin. And so Jerry was going to Alabama. But I recruited the hell out of him, and I loved him. So those are probably my two biggest recruiting regrets. I've seen a couple people, Buckeye fans, ask about DPJ, Donovan Peoples-Jones, and about his recruiting story. And I had a couple people say, man, I thought he was going to become a Buckeye. You thought wrong. you can't have a better kid, a smarter kid, a great family. His mom's awesome. But we were never in it. I never thought we were in it. His parents were Michigan grads. That kid was going to Michigan from day one, and we recruited the hell out of him. Now, funny story. So right before he made his decision, we had to go do a home visit. It was winter. I can't remember, like December. And so we had to go. I mean, it was one of those, like, this huge snowstorm hit, but we had to go. Like, he was going to make his decision, and we couldn't not go despite this monstrous, winter freeze. So we fly up there, Urban, me, and Kerry Combs, we fly up there. land, go to his house, do a home visit, great family. We go to leave and we find out that the private jet can't land to pick us up. So we're like, ah, shit. Like we got to figure out how to get back to Columbus. And so we're going to drive to Toledo because that's the closest place that the private jet could land. In this, I mean, I'm talking about like, it was one of those winter snowstorms that was like, you were not allowed to be on the road. And so Carrie Combs has a car and I have a car. And so of course, what always happens in that situation is like, oh shit, who's going to get stuck with Urban? Like, I don't want to ride with him. I just want to have a nice drive by myself. So naturally, being the younger guy, I got the honor of being with Urban in the car. So we go to get in the car and he's like, give me the keys. And I was like, and that never happens. I was like, yo, you don't want me to drive? And he looked at me, he goes, listen, if we're going to die, I'm going to kill us. And I started laughing. I was like, all right, let me tell you something. This son of a bitch is a maniac driving in the snow. I'm talking about, and he was born and raised in Northeast Ohio, has plenty of experience, but we're flying. I mean, passing people, he's in the shoulder, we're fishtailing. I'm sitting here like clutched to the armrest, like terrified. We leave Carrie Combs in our dust. So we're getting there. We get to the airport and Carrie's like 20 minutes behind us. And Urban's like, hey, text Carrie, see where he's at. And I'm texting him. He's like, I'm at this mile marker. I'm like, holy shit, you're 20 minutes away. And Urban's like, see what he has going on. Because Urban doesn't want to wait. And we're sitting there and I'm like, coach wants to know, like, do you have a lot going on? Like, do you need to be on this plane? And he's like, no, it's okay. You guys go ahead.
He's going to leave him in Toledo.
So he's literally like the plan now is as we pull into the FBO, like this private airport, is we're leaving Carrie. He's screwed. He's got to drive back all the way from Toledo in a snowstorm. We're not waiting. And fortunately for Carrie, the pilots weren't ready yet. So they by the time they got ready, he made it. And he ended up flying out. But I was sitting there like, wow, you talk about some selfish shit. Now, we're about to leave this guy so we can get home 20 minutes earlier. And he's going to have to drive in a snowstorm all the way from Toledo to Columbus. It was hilarious. But yeah, that's just a couple recruiting stories.
Okay, so last episode, we did a top 10 countdown, and I think we want to do another one this week, or this episode.
Yep.
So what I want to know is the top 10 game day atmospheres. What stadiums are your top 10
Absolutely.
Of all time?
Yeah. So I want to preface this by saying these are going to be the top 10 game day atmospheres that I've coached in. Yes. So if a school's not on the list, like, I don't know, Notre Dame or somewhere, I've never coached there. It's not that they're not in the top 10. I don't want to speak to it because I've never been there. But the top 10 game day atmospheres, counting down from 10 that I've coached in, right? Number 10 would be Neyland Stadium, the University of Tennessee. And that's, they only made the list because of the Phil Fulmer tenure. Because the last time I was there, it was unimpressive. But as far as an awesome place to go, like
it's a beautiful city. Oh my and God. Just the mountains and it's all up and downhill.
And,
I love it.
You talk about a bucket list place to go, like 102,455 fans in a beautiful stadium that love football. I mean, it's really cool because they have a river that goes right up to the stadium and these big time Tennessee boosters will like pull their yachts in. Yeah,
the Vol Navy, right?
Yeah, right. And tailgate on the river. I mean, it looks really cool. I've obviously never experienced that part. As an opposing school coming in, it's the most annoying place ever. They play Rocky Top for everything. It's like they sell a hot dog. Play Rocky Top. Rocky Top, Tennessee. It's like, Jesus Christ, man, you gained 5 yards. Don't play Rocky Top. But I'm sure for a Tennessee fan, it's awesome. But yeah, that's it's a good place to play. It's definitely down right now, as I discussed earlier in a previous episode. But it's number 10. Number 9 would have to be Oklahoma. I was slightly disappointed when we went there. I was expecting more. It was a night game, the whole deal. It was loud. It was cool. But it wasn't like some of the SEC and top-tier Big Ten atmospheres I've been in. Only 86,000 fans, which is kind of weird. I thought it'd be more, especially a program as strong and as historic as Oklahoma. But it was cool. I mean, I would not go out of my way to go see a game there. But if you have the opportunity, it's definitely worth it.
Well, what makes you rank it above Neyland then?
It was a night game, and I think the atmosphere and everything right now supersedes Neyland.
Okay.
But Neyland, back when Tennessee was cooking, probably is much higher on the list. But if I was going to go to a game right now, I would put Oklahoma over Tennessee. Number eight, probably a little surprising, is South Carolina, Williams-Brice Stadium. It is surprisingly intimidating. I never would have expected it. When we went there, it was loud, like really loud. Only 80,000 some fans, but it was loud. And they play this damn rooster noise.
Yeah.
Another really annoying thing.
The Gamecock gobble.
Yeah, it is like...
Every first down.
It is so annoying to an opposing team, but awesome. And you know, one of the cooler entrances, like they come out. What's that song that they play? It's like a... one of those sci-fi movie songs, but they play it and the rooster's in a cage shaking it and the stadium's rocking. It's really cool. Definitely a place I would check out if you're nearby. Again, not a place I'd go out of my way to go see, but it's a cool place. Number seven, which is the home to the loudest moment I've ever heard in a football game, is Auburn, their stadium. It was 2007, 2005-ish, maybe. They blocked a punt against us. We were in the booth, and I'm talking about never does this happen. We couldn't hear the headsets. We're in the booth. It happens a lot in these big-time places on the field.
On the field, for sure.
But we were in the booth and couldn't hear. That's how loud it was. It was really cool. 87,000-some fans. It was loud, really loud. So I would definitely put that one on a bucket list. I think the top seven are bucket list worthy. So Auburn, number seven. Number six, a place I've been to, I don't know, 50 times, would be the Swamp in Florida. Only like 90,000 fans, but a night game in the Swamp is insane. When we beat South Carolina...
I was going to bring that up. That's the loudest moment I've ever heard. Field goal, correct?
We blocked... Jarvis Moss. Jarvis Moss
got a finger
blocked
on it.
A field goal to beat South Carolina. Steve Spurrier's homecoming into the Swamp. One of the loudest moments I've heard. Not louder than that Auburn moment, but it was loud.
That had to have been 2007, because I think that was the national championship year.
06.
Yeah, okay.
2006.
So it was six.
National championship year, 06. And I've heard... and I've seen pictures that the Swamp has really taken a dive. It was a sellout every game we ever coached there. And I mean, I'm talking about we played Western Carolina, it was sold out. And I've seen pictures now, like mid-game, where it's like half full. So that's depressing. But it was at least a ridiculous atmosphere. Getting into the top five, number five would have to be Wisconsin. Jump around is one of the coolest things in sports. Being Wisconsin fans, it really motivates and fires up the opposing
everyone.
Team.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Everyone.
And it's pumped. Really cool. I mean, I've heard when you're in the stands, you can feel the stadium moving, but it is wild. I mean, both teams are jumping around. You talk about excitement. And when we beat them in overtime in 2016, it was an electric atmosphere.
That was the game I was going to bring up. I was at that game. And I mean, it was insane.
Oh,
absolutely insane.
What was it? Like quadruple overtime, something crazy. Yeah,
just ridiculous.
It was Noah Brown overtime touchdown catch. I remember that. And it's definitely a bucket list. Like you got to go see a game at Wisconsin, a night game at Wisconsin. Got to do it. Got to be on the list. Number four is Alabama. And this is, in my experience, was Alabama pre-renovation. So this is like 05, I think, was the last time, only time I've been there. And it was insane. The fans were insane. It was loud. It was crazy. They have these lights.
Well, that was before Saban then, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was that
it was,
crazy
it
then?
It was still that crazy. And I can't imagine now.
Yeah.
I bet you it's higher on the list. But it was 102,000 fans. And their lights, this is bizarre. I don't know, bizarre tidbit, but their lights are, I don't know what they are, but they're different than anywhere else I've ever been. Like, it's almost like HD. Like, I guess real life is HD, but you're on the field and you feel like, man, like, I can see clearer than anywhere else, which I know is kind of an irrelevant.
They got the, like, LED daylight bulbs instead
I don't know
of
what it
soft
is,
but, white or whatever.
It's a random, irrelevant fact, but I just thought of it. Alabama was crazy. And so I'd imagine now it's even more insane, but it's really cool. Number three, don't shoot me, Ohio State fans, but the horseshoe is number three on my list. It is a must-see, an awesome atmosphere, awesome stadium, night game in the horseshoe, rivals anything. Now, a day game in the horseshoe, pretty average, pretty quiet.
There's only one day game in the horseshoe that really matters that is fun to go to, and that's Michigan.
For sure, for sure. But it's like any stadium. You really got to evaluate day games too, right? Like, I mean, it's in Ohio Stadium's just – it's okay in a day game. Night games, insane, insane. Got to see, must see, must see TV. It's awesome. Number two, we're going to really piss the Big Ten fans off now.
Yeah, they're going to be mad.
Number two is the whiteout in Penn State. The second coolest sports moment, which I've experienced it twice, and it is an absolute must-see. Got to do it. Got to find a way to go to a whiteout at Penn State. It is awesome. The pom-poms shaking, loud. You can't hear. You can't think. You can't do anything. It is one of the most intimidating atmospheres in all of sport. It is awesome.
Yeah, my experience at the whiteout was obviously a bad one because I was an Ohio State fan, and that's the one where they blocked the field goal and took it back. But the stadium itself is so crazy because everybody's in white, and not even just in white, but like head to toe white, like body painted, everything. Right. Everybody goes all out for that.
It's awesome. It is really cool. That leads us to our number one game day atmosphere. And I'm going to be honest, in my experience, not even close. A night game in Death Valley at LSU. It is like I can't even put into words. Insane.
I've heard you don't want to be an away team there.
You don't want to be an away fan team.
Anything.
I don't know if you want to be a home fan. That's how wild it is. I mean, I'm talking about throwing batteries
at
people, fighting people. Those Cajuns don't play. And I'll never forget, in 2007, Tim Tebow's Heisman year, we went there and ended up losing, but it was like one of those number one versus number three night game in Death Valley. Probably the coolest atmosphere I've ever seen. And that week, you talk about crazy fans, somehow LSU fans got a hold of Tim Tebow's phone number. And he would come up to meetings, and he'd always stop in my office, and he would play some of the voice messages. Wow. You talk about ruthless. And so the coolest thing that happened was he went off, had a great game. We ended up losing, but he had a career day. And he scored a touchdown right in front of their student section. And when he scored, he flipped the ball, looked at him, dialed his cell phone, put it up to his and pointed at him like, I got your messages, bitch. It was awesome. So that's definitely number one.
I love the tiger eye at the 50-yard line.
Oh, yeah.
That's
And nothing's more intimidating than walking out of your locker room and there's a live goddamn tiger right there. Like a real one.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It's unbelievable.
I noticed there was a certain place missing from your list there.
Yeah.
I have another one that's missing that I'll mention. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
I noticed there was no Michigan on the list. I mean, for the Big House, it's the biggest stadium in the country, holds the most fans. How could it not be on the list?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Michigan fans. It's just so I guess a caveat and an excuse for Michigan fans is obviously coaching at Ohio State, never been there at night. So that's an unfair disadvantage for the Big House. However, it is a poorly, poorly built stadium for that big of a crowd. I mean, it is a huge open bowl. And to be honest, you can't be on the top 10 if the opposing fans do the O-H-I-O chant in your stadium.
All the way around.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, when we went there, I guess by the end of the game, it was a home game because they all left. But it was really unimpressive. The fans aren't that loud. I'm sorry. They're just not. And I've been there prior to my career at Ohio State. I've been there as a fan. I mentioned it. I went there to an Ohio State-Michigan game, and it was, I mean, it was cool. It was loud. Like, it was an experience, but it's not something that I'd say you got to do. It was just average.
Well, the one that I noticed that I've always been scared to death because they come out with that Seminole on the horse. Is that not intimidating? It always looked intimidating to me on TV.
It's similar to Michigan. I mean, it's
really
it's a pretty stadium on the outside, like brick, gold. They got the statue of the horse and the Chief Osceola. But you get in there, it's a really shitty stadium inside, really rickety and gross, and it's just okay. I mean, the war chant they do is cool, but
gets old probably.
Yeah, it's just average. I wouldn't put it high up on the list either. The one that I was really disappointed with the most probably is Oklahoma, though. It's just not that impressive. I expected more. And I'll never forget in 2016 we played them. And I can't remember the coach, but a guy was commentating. it was like the Jerry DiNardo or someone like that who was a successful coach. It might have been Barry Switzer even. So we came out in 2016, and our team came out, and you had to kind of go around the field to get to our half of the field. And as we came out, the Oklahoma players were chirping. I mean, ran over to the sideline in our face, talking trash, and our players didn't even look at them. And whoever the coach was that was commentating, I remember he told Urban, he said, the minute your team came out in pregame, I knew the game was over. Because they were chirping, all this hype, all this bullshit, and your team didn't even look at them.
They just came out all business.
Just marched down the field, warmed up, and beat the shit out of them. And obviously they came back to Ohio Stadium the next year and got a little revenge. But but that game was definitely some prima donnas that needed to get smacked. And I remember Noah Brown had four touchdowns, and just we just beat the brakes off of them. And they returned the favor a year later, for sure.
They planted a flag.
Yeah, they did.
Someone did.
That was my guy, Baker. He did it. So the one thing, another thing I wanted to get into, a lot of people have asked about Ryan Day and how he's going to be. I've talked about him a little bit. And I do want to get into kind of his background that I don't, I mean, anybody with Google can find out. But I guess there's a lot of fans that are concerned, like, what's the direction he's going to go? Here's an NFL guy, dropback guy. He had Dwayne Haskins. He's got Justin Fields now. Where's he going to go? Like, is he going to be able to adapt the offense? The one thing I want to tell you about Ryan Day, first of all, he's one of the best X's and O's coaches I've ever been around, ever. He's very, very intelligent. He also has a background with athletic quarterbacks. I don't know if people realize that because he was an NFL coach. Then he was the Dwayne Haskins coach. But he was a coordinator and quarterback coach under Steve Adazio at Boston College, and Steve's a big quarterback run guy. He was really into athletic quarterbacks, equalizing the game with numbers. And Ryan has an extensive background with athletic quarterbacks, so he'll have a really, really nice package for Justin Fields, assuming he will be that athletic guy. And he obviously is going to have throw game. The best thing he does is he has high percentage throw game for any quarterback. I mean, little drag routes, pick routes, mesh routes, things that get a quarterback started, get some momentum going.
Well, and he's not going to just fit a quarterback to his system. He's going to fit the system to his quarterback and the offense.
And that's what makes a great coach, and that's what he did well. I mean, obviously the offense was very different under Ryan Day's tutelage with JT Barrett as quarterback and then with Dwayne Haskins as the quarterback, and it will shift right back. It'll be an efficient offense regardless of the personnel. He'll find a way to utilize who they have. And there's this urban influence and stigma that was there in 2017 with JT, because Urban was obsessed with quarterback run because it's the only way to equalize numbers. Because if the quarterback hands the ball to a running back, you are automatically down one player. That quarterback can do nothing for you. So Urban was always obsessed with running the quarterback because that was a way to have 10 guys blocking or taking someone out of the picture. And then it ended up being a one-on-one game. Yep. And he had this stigma of not ever trying to find a way to give the ball to a running back. And you saw it, and we talk about the Michigan State game. That's why JT ran it so much against Michigan State. Because when things didn't go well, Urban was just like, run the quarterback, run the quarterback. They're loading the box. We got to equate numbers. Run the quarterback, run the quarterback. And Ryan was able to get away from that, and now without Urban's influence, we'll be able to utilize a run game with a running back. And he'll run the quarterback. He will. But it's not going to be the sole focus. On third and four, it's not going to be line up and empty, motion a tight end in, run JT up the middle. It's not going to be that way. And that was Urban's deal, man. Third and short, run JT. We called it – it was cross flow, split zone, whatever you want to call it. It was bring the tight end in motion, run JT. And it was highly efficient, but that's what we called. I mean, and everyone knew it. It was hard to stop because we equated numbers. But Ryan will do a great job with the personnel he has. And 2018, and really what you saw it, and 2017 also, but you saw Urban's trust in Ryan Day because he was able to pull himself away from the offense and let Ryan run the show. And 2017, it was better. 2018, even better as far as running the running backs, giving the ball to the running backs, letting Dwayne throw the ball, you know, those things that we missed out on in 16 and 15. And so Ryan's going to do a great job adapting to the personnel for sure. All right. Well, now we want to get into our Q&A segment of the show. And I want to tell you that, one, we appreciate the questions. I mean, it is overwhelming. We are so far behind on answering the questions. I can't even begin to explain it. So we definitely want to take more questions today and answer them to try to catch up. We're not going to catch up, but we'll at least make a dent on the questions. But don't stop sending them. We love the questions. It gives us insight into what you want to hear. And it also helps us provide you with answers. So let's knock out some of these questions.
All right, sounds good. Our first question is from a guy named Nash. He wants to know, what is Brett McMurphy's vendetta against Ohio State, in your opinion? I know after he published your story, he published that fake story about Trayvon Grimes. So just wondering what you think his deal is.
Oh, man, my guy. My guy, Brett. I think Brett McMurphy is one of those douchebags that is kind of spineless, cowardice. And what he is he was a fired reporter. A reporter that was dying to get back into the game and would really say anything, do anything, take anyone down without any journalistic integrity, anything for clicks, anything to get relevant, anything to try to create momentum in his career to climb back up because he'd obviously been knocked down. And I guess that was his motivation. I don't know what personally he has against me, but he's such a coward that he refused to vet any story. He contacted me, I mean, 6 months after he already put everything out there. So I don't have a good answer. But I know this, a real man, a real woman, a real reporter doesn't operate that way. So just food for thought, reporters, this show, ESPN, whatever, CBS, they all feed off of your clicks, your interaction, your attention. So if you give them attention, they're relevant. If you don't, they're not. No different than this show. If you don't listen to this show, it becomes irrelevant. If you do, it's relevant. So you have the power. And if you provide power to Brett McMurphy's of the world, then you provide power to them and they're relevant. But I don't know what his issue was, but he definitely has one.
Okay, so next one comes from Stephen H. Do coaches leak information about the team, more specifically about recruitment? And can you name your inside guy? Interesting that people can crystal ball guys to certain places.
Yeah, so this sports media, especially when it pertains to recruiting, is very interesting because there is a select handful at each, I don't know, school that have great information, inside sources. And I did. I talked to probably one or two guys pretty regularly because as a coach, you love the insight. You love the information because they talk like there's restrictions on how much a coach can talk to a recruit, specifically before September 1st. Of their senior year. You can't call them. You can't do anything. And so they definitely have insight. And so you want to find the ones that are real and really good at their job and kind of use them to help you. And then in turn, they use you to get inside information. But there's only a handful. And what happens is these handful of guys break stories and break news. And then these other sites break the same news a couple minutes later. And it's, again, who you feed your energy into. One of the guys that I used all the time who is really good and has a ton of insider info. He talks to kids, talks to players on the team, talks to coaches, and he's really good at his job is Jeremy Birmingham. I don't know where he is now. He was at the Athletic, and he was at 11 Warriors at one point. I think he's at Letterman's Row now. But he was really good. He was somebody that gave me a lot of information, and I would tell him things because he was trustworthy. If you said, hey, bro, I don't want this out there, but just kind of on put it on your radar, you know, Jalen Holmes might commit. He would not tell a soul. And then there's some guys like Bill Kurelek or whatever. I don't even know how you say his name. Where he would just talk to no one, know nothing, doesn't have a clue. He would see Jalen Holmes give you a hug and tweet a story about it. And you're like, bro, like, Jalen didn't want people to know about that, you douchebag. Why are you doing that? Like, this is a kid. This is his life. But they just write an article and want people to click it. They don't give a shit. And so that's what you deal with. So there are a handful, yes. Do coaches talk to them? Yes. Does Mark Pantone talk to them? Absolutely. But there's only a couple that actually have a clue. You got to find out who they are. And it's not that hard. They're the ones breaking the stories that actually have quotes from kids. And it's not hard to figure out. And once you do, follow them. Listen to them. They are talking to the kids and the coaches and the program.
All right. So our next one comes from Taylor Johnson. Do you think Pruitt has what it takes to turn Tennessee around and make it a respectable program again? As a Tennessee fan, I just want my team to compete and not get blown out every single week.
Oh, man. That's all we can ask for, right, Taylor? Is just don't get blown out every week. I don't know. I don't know Jeremy Pruitt that well. I will tell you this, the good and the bad, right? The good is he is a graduate of the Nick Saban School for Coaching. We talked about it last week, right? He learned from the best coach in college football. So he's got a chance, right? There's a fighting chance. If he just mimics Saban's program, he's got a chance. He's fighting an uphill battle. I've always said this about Tennessee, and it's what's surprising about the success that Phil Fulmer had. Tennessee's not an easy place because it's not Georgia. You're not in the thick of 100 great players. The state of Tennessee has probably 5 elite players a year. And those kids aren't always staying home. It's not cool to stay home in Tennessee. Now, every now and then they will, and that's what you can hope that he gets done, is builds a wall around the state. But I know when Butch Jones was there, there was kids, I mean, just walking to Clemson, trying to get out of there. And so that's his task. That's his challenge. The negative is he was like the 17th. We talked about it last week. He was like the 17th choice for Tennessee. So do I think he's going to turn it around? Shit, Tennessee didn't think he was going to turn it around. He was their 17th pick, but he's got a chance. Recruiting is going to be the key, right? Can he recruit? And now he's battling some big boy recruiters in that conference. So I don't know. If I was betting, I'd say no, but I he's got a chance.
Yep, definitely. Well, our next one comes from Brandon Marshall.
Like the receiver, Brandon Marshall?
Yeah, I have to assume it's the wide receiver from the NFL.
Must be. But must be the celebrity.
Especially when you hear the question.
Oh.
Could you talk about the transition of Braxton Miller from quarterback to wide receiver and how quickly that came about? If Brandon remembers correctly, that announcement happened either right before or right at the beginning of fall camp in 2015. How difficult or crazy was that to have a transition, a lifetime quarterback, into a big-time D1 caliber wide receiver in 1 month?
That's a great question. Matter of fact, let's add that to next week's episode. I want to talk about that entire story because Brax is one of my favorite guys that I've been around, coached. He's awesome. And it's definitely tough. And I could talk technically about the physiological transformation that you need to make from a quarterback or running back to receiver, because I've done that a lot in my career. The Curtis Samuels, Dontre Wilson, Braxton Miller, you know, I've done that quite a few times. And it's not easy, but an elite talent like Braxton makes it fun. And Braxton and I put in a lot of hard work to get him to where he got, which still was far from maximized. I mean, having only 6 months to do it. But yeah, I want to talk about that entirely because there's some great stories that go along with that involving Urban Meyer, Pete Thamel, who broke the story and the quotes, and I almost got fired. There's a bunch of stuff that goes into it. So let's make sure we write that down and talk about it next episode.
Next question comes from Bobby G. Zach, love the podcast. Listening now, actually. You touched on something briefly, and it made me think of a question. What was / is the relationship between Urban and Tressel like? Did Urban think, I whooped this guy, I don't need to learn anything from him when he was at OSU? Also, was he bitter about not having a chance to win the 2012 title based on what happened under Tressel? Also, what are your thoughts on Tressel? Many of us feel like that whole situation with tattoos was ridiculously blown out of proportion.
Yeah. So Urban took the job at Ohio State under one condition. He talked to people in the NCAA. He made it very clear with the Ohio State administration. He was not going to even consider the job if there was any chance there'd be sanctions put against the program. And his sources in the NCAA said, absolutely not. It's not a big enough deal for sanctions. Obviously, the administration at Ohio State said, we've cooperated, done everything. There will be no sanctions. Fast forward 3 months, boom, sanctions hit. It was devastating. I don't think he blamed Jim Tressel for it. Him and Jim Tressel are friends. He respected the shit out of Tressel, what he was able to accomplish, him as a coach, the program he built. He had a lot of admiration for him. But he also used what happened, the tattoo gate, the Tressel scandal. He used all of that as a moment of teaching for coaches, because you're not going to find someone with higher moral character than Jim Tressel. And he got caught up in not reporting things properly and caring about a player and players more than kind of having transparency. And he used to bring it up all the time. Compliance was in every meeting we had. He used to tell our coaches in front of compliance, if there's ever an issue, you go right to him. You tell him right away, you fix it, find a solution, report it. And it was all because of what happened to Tressel. And to be honest with you, happened what Ohio State went through and what Jim Tressel did, created a really negative monster at Ohio State. This guy, Doug Archie, that runs the compliance office is, I mean, he's horrendous. He makes it so hard to be on the same team. And it's stressful because as a coach and coaching staff, you want to be compliant unless you're just an absolute shitbag and cheating. You want to do what's right. You want to be on the same team with your compliance department. But what happened with Tattoo Gate and everything has created an atmosphere that's hard to do that. And I know the direct compliance guy with football is really good about dealing with the coaches. And so anyways, back to the question. There was a lot of respect for Tressel. They're friends, a lot to learn from him. And he was really appreciative of the program he built and the our ability to enhance it.
Okay, great. Max Arena wants to know, what are the best high school football programs nationally that you interacted with? And then locally here in Columbus, even though I know you're a South Florida guy, what high school programs are elite for Central Ohio?
Ooh, what a great question. So I'll start not, obviously I have an affinity for South Florida, recruited there forever, great football, some great programs, awesome people, awesome coaches, and I mean the most talented area I've been in. I'll start outside of that. Probably the coolest high school I've ever been to is Bishop Gorman High School. I signed through two players from there, recruited five or six, and it is awesome. It's one of the few programs there. Head coach is just a head coach, doesn't teach anything. They have an offensive and defensive coordinator that do nothing but offensive and defensively coordinate. They have a lot of money. They have a lot of donors, a lot of big money people. The guy that the field's named after, Lorenzo Fertitta, started UFC with a couple other guys, donated millions of dollars. This facility is gorgeous. Weight room with glass in the end zone, overlooking the game field, big stadium, one of the top, you know, two or three programs year in, year out in the country. And it's definitely an awesome high school. Down in South Florida, I could think of three that are different from each other. The two that are big time, big money programs are St. Thomas Aquinas, ridiculous. George Smith is a legend. The guy, Roger Harriet, that's the coach there now, is one of the finest men I've ever met and a great coach. Recruited a number of great players out of there. Obviously, Ohio State fans know about them. In Florida, we had a bunch of them too, the major rights of the world, and Marcus Gilbert, all the way to Nick Bosa's and Trayvon Grimes, who we'll talk about in a later episode. And then American Heritage is another one. Pat Surtain was a great NFL player, is the head coach there now. Mike Rumpf used to be there. Now he's at Miami. Great program. It's where he recruited Torrance Gibson, another person we're going to talk about in a later episode. Another one in South Florida that I love is Deerfield Beach. The guy named Coach Glenn is the head coach there. He's a genuine dude, great coach, hard as shit, tough as shit on his players. A lot of the area kids train at that high school, like Ben Victor trained there and didn't go there. But that's a great program. So those are four off the top of my head. The one in Columbus, I'm a little biased. alumni. So Dublin Kaufman High School, Mark Crabtree does a phenomenal job there. Great program, great football, great history. Really awesome place. Like I said, a little biased though. So those are the ones off the top of my head I'd throw out there.
Okay. Shad Foster wants to know, he would love to hear about the James Quick recruiting background and when he picked Louisville instead of Ohio State University.
Yeah, this is a message to all recruits, and I should have put him in one of my biggest regrets. He was the number one receiver in the country, one of the most talented kids I've seen. I think it was 2012 he came out. And this is a testament to recruits. If you are a recruit or know a recruit, tell him to tune into this message. James Quick went to Louisville because he grew up a Louisville fan, committed to us at Ohio State right before the Army All-American game. Wanted to go to Louisville because Charlie Strong was there. Going to be the coach there forever, right? Lifetime coach, Charlie Strong. How'd that work out? But wanted to go there, wanted to play for Charlie Strong. Louisville ended up beating the brakes off of Florida, number four Florida in the bowl game. And his passion and love for Louisville just flipped him right then and there. Committed the next day at the Army All-American game. We didn't know what was happening. Completely lost him. Enrolled shortly thereafter. It was done. And we were devastated. He was our top, one of our top kids on our board. The top receiver for sure. Fast forward to this day, his dad has reached out to me a couple times because the kid regretted every second of his decision. He knew Ohio State was a better fit. It was better for his future, better for his development. But he went to Louisville because it was a small school. He could be the star. He could stay at home. He loved Louisville, wanted to be a Cardinal, and regretted every second of that decision. And so I would challenge recruits to go where you are going to get developed, coached, and maximized. Because sometimes going to that smaller school to start right away and get more touches, it's not what's in your best interest in the long run. So, yeah, it was a wild story. It wasn't fun. We were devastated and the kid regretted it. So that's the opposite side, right? You see the success stories all the time. What you don't want to see is the James Quick story. They made a bad decision that they regret. You hate that.
Well, let's talk about three kids that definitely did not make bad decisions they regret. Kyle Freeman wants to know, on the next episode, I'd love to hear about what it was like coaching Paris Campbell, Terry, and Johnny. They seem like the most genuine, hardworking dudes I've seen at play at wide receiver.
Yeah, most coaches never have or will have the opportunity to coach three kids like that. They were three best friends, just great kids, as good of kids as you could get. Hard workers. They weren't initially, but they developed into captains, hard workers. It was a dream. I mean, you talk about an easy job. It was coaching them the last year of their of my time at Ohio State. Now, when they first came in, it was really hard. Going back to that project about Urban Meyer and how he abused players, they hated it at Ohio State when they first got there. I mean, hated it. They hated me. They hated Urban. They hated the program. And right now, if you ask them, they love Urban, they love me, and love the program because that's what development is. And they developed. They were program guys and always will be. And they're excellent. I mean, great players, great kids, and just they were a dream to coach. And I'm sure Hartline would echo those sentiments after coaching them for a year.
I feel like if you really look at that wide receiver room that Brian Hartline had, those three guys really set the culture for that room, well, I have to imagine.
They set the culture for the team. Mm-hmm. And that's crazy coming from receivers because that never happens. But they did, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Okay, C. Ryan wants to know, he's a big fan of Dontre Wilson, and he has a couple questions. Why wasn't he utilized more? He was so fast. And do you think he can still make an NFL roster?
Oh, Dontre. Dontre is another interesting story of kids I coached. And I definitely put that on the list also. Yep. Talk about another episode because I got a couple great stories about Dontre. But yeah, he's a talented kid. Of course, he could still make an NFL roster. Anything's possible. But we'll get into Dontre and maybe next episode because that's going to be a longer story. And I don't want to take up too much time with this Q&A. So great question, though.
Okay, Nick Brom. How do you find high school recruits? Where, when, how does the recruiting process start? When do you first start watching film on that player, and where do you go from there?
So it's different at every program. The way we did it at Ohio State, Mark Pantone really ran the show and runs the show. He would give you a list of kids to watch. Obviously, when you go out on the road, you find out about players. You evaluate them as you meet them, find them, whatever. And you rely on high school coaches to promote them. But with nowadays at a program like Ohio State, there's a whole recruiting department. And it's made our jobs as coaches back then so easy because they would give you a list. Here's the 40 receivers that we think are worthy of you watching. And so you're really relying on them to not cut a guy that's going to end up being a great player. And again, that's kind of pre-evaluation. Then once you go on the road and get out there, you start hearing about players, seeing players, then you can really dive in and find out more about them. And you'll find guys under the radar that maybe you love, like the Terry McLaurins of the world, right? Cameron Brown, who's at Ohio State right now, wasn't on any list we had. And I recruited Cameron Babb. He's his high school teammate. I loved him. I fell in love with him as a player, a kid, everything. I brought him back and pounded the table for him. Sure enough, we offered him. He committed, and he's at Ohio State. And he'll be a great corner at Ohio State at some point. And that's kind of how it works. Some guys you find out about going through the process when you're out on the road traveling, and some guys are just on your radar because the recruiting department hands you a list, and the guy's name's right there. And so they cut up the film, you evaluate it, you do your evaluation, rank them, and go from there. Start recruiting.
Do you ever look at, like, say, a 24/7 sports and use some of their information, or is it mostly that stuff for the fan?
I mean, I looked at it. I always looked at it just because it's interesting to see where they rank guys, and it's also frustrating because you're looking at it like, Jesus, you can't be serious. Like, this kid's the number one receiver in the country, and this kid's number seven. But everyone has an opinion. But, yeah, I always looked at it. It mm-hmm. gives you something to read, something entertaining, and at the end of the day, it's the only way to kind of keep score. Yeah. I mean, we never recruited to those lists. We never took a kid because he was ranked high, but it was nice to see, oh crap, we're first in the Big Ten, or I'm the number one recruiter in the country. You're in the Big Ten. Or mm-hmm. I mean, you looked at it, but it didn't matter.
Yeah. Okay. So Tony Avila has two questions, one personal and one football.
Oh, good.
We'll start with the football one. Did Urban or Ryan Day at any point during the 2017 season seriously consider benching JT Barrett for Dwayne Haskins, especially after the Oklahoma loss?
No, they didn't seriously consider it. JT was too great of a leader, and I think they would have never considered it because he was such a good leader. Should they have? Maybe.
after we beat the team up north and JT got hurt, I thought if we'd have rode Dwayne into the Big Ten championship and won bigger than we did, we would have been in the playoff. So I'm not saying I didn't want JT to play, but that was probably should have been the decision considering JT wasn't 100%. But there was no serious consideration by them. Mm-hmm. They were too big of JT Barrett fans and supporters, and they love the kid. He was just that great of a leader, and to a fault, maybe they loved him, but they did. And that's why he was the quarterback.
Yep. All right. So now the personal question he has. Has your wife's alimony / child support gravy train ended now that you are unemployed? Seems to me she killed her own golden goose. What could possibly be her motivation for doing what she did?
Yeah, I don't want to get into her motivation because I have no idea. But yeah, I don't pay her anything. It's hard to pay her anything when I lost my job. And plus I have my kids 50% of the time now, so there's no need for child support. We have them equally, and you shouldn't pay child support if you have them equally. You both should get a job and you both should pay for them when you have them. That's how it should work. And that's how it's going to work. Yeah, it's funny because the month after I got fired, she was like irate that she didn't get her money. And I'm like, I don't know if you read the news, but you got me fired, psycho. You made up a bunch of bullshit and got me fired. You think you're going to get money now? What's wrong with you? But whatever, everyone has their own reasons, and God only knows hers. I think that book deal she was going to get fell through, and that lawsuit she was going to have against Ohio State didn't matriculate, but I'm sure she's doing well. So I don't know. I don't know why she did it, but no, she's not getting anything from me.
All right, so Todd Lamb wants to know, players having children while at Ohio State, how big of an issue is it, and what did Urban do to try to educate players about protecting themselves?
Yeah, I mean, there was sex education every offseason to talk about how not to get people pregnant. But no, I mean, there's players with kids, a number of them. I had one, Corey Smith, had six kids. And so there was definitely, that was a hurdle for those players to overcome because they're trying to be a dad, trying to manage that, which everyone that is a father or a mother knows how stressful that can be. And then couple that with being a college student and a college football player. So it was tough. There was times where Corey Smith, his fiance would have to work. He'd be in charge of the kids. He'd need to work out, and he'd show up with four kids and be like, "Coach, can they hang out in your office while I work out?" And I'm like, "Holy shit!" I'm trying to, you know, get some work done, and I got four kids running around. But I loved them; they were awesome. But yeah, it happens. It was definitely educated, but I mean, it's part of being 20. If you have a kid, I mean, they were got to be a great father and figure it out. So I think that's enough questions for now. Obviously, this is a longer episode than normal, but we wanted to get caught up on those Q&As. So I just kind of preview where we're going with this. Obviously, we talked about a couple things we're going to talk about in the future episodes. Also want to talk about false accusations, my experience personally and also with athletes that I know who dealt with it, and how inept Ohio State University is equipped to structure and is structured to handle it. A little spoiler alert, they have fucked up a lot. And I'd imagine most schools are inept at handling it, that side of it. Also want to start getting into positional breakdowns, national football analysis, and conferences, kind of where we're at, where I think teams will finish based on my knowledge. Also want to talk about the state of college football. I talked about it before. It's a Nick Saban versus Dabo Sweeney world. Also want to throw in, there's a sprinkle of Lincoln Riley in there. Want to talk about them and break down the difference for good and bad. I want to talk about offensive rankings, analysis on the Big Ten and SEC, and get into some more current events as we move forward. So again, thank you for joining us. We surpassed 75,000 downloads. Want to see that increase. Make sure you subscribe and download now on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, or go to our website at menacetosocietypodcast.com, or shoot me an email at Zach, Z-A-C-H, at menacetosocietypodcast.com. Again, like I always say, hope you enjoyed it. Hope you were entertained. Hope you learned something about the inner workings of college football and appreciate your interest. If you liked it, please tell people about it. Share it. Retweet it. Tell your friends. Word of mouth spreads. And we really want to make this thing go. So please share it on social media. And if you like it, we appreciate it. If you don't like it, go fuck yourself, San Diego.
Menace to society.